The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Greetings, everyone. I'm Jennifer Green for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is That's a Laugh. For the next half hour, I'll be reading excerpts of funny stories, quotes, and other anecdotes from various sources that we hope will add a few chuckles to your day. In today's episode, we have stories of strength, with a healthy dose of humor, in true towel fashion, of course. From how far the profession of secretaries has come, to understanding that some things just require good old-fashioned healthy choices, to accepting that sometimes things that happen as we age are just what make us us. All of today's stories are from the book Laugh Out Loud, 40 Women Humorists Celebrate Then and Now, Before We Forget, published in 2018, and written by Aaliyah Zobel Nolan, with contributions from Irma Bombeck Writers Workshop. Without further ado, on to our first story. Some days the best thing about my job is that the chair spins. NobleCards.com. Take a Letter, Miss Jones, by Aaliyah Zobel Nolan. If space were allotted by the number of different hats business people wore, secretaries, a.k.a. administrative assistants, wouldn't sit in cubicles. They'd have offices the size of a football field. Indeed, with the exception of mothers and housewives, few people do so many things so fast and so well. Still, stereotypes are hard to shake, and the old movie and TV portrait of the clock-watching, gum-snapping Girl Friday, think 9 to 5 and Mad Men, the girl in the tight sweater who made more phone calls than she answered, is, unfortunately, a lingering one. Even in this day and age, admin assistants, like the late Rodney Dangerfield complained, are still notorious for getting no respect. Nevertheless, though the profession may not yet get all the recognition it deserves, it's a billion times better than when I sat behind a selectric. A typical secretary's day back then was full of clerical challenges. Mind you, this was way back in the BCs, before computers. Retyping mounds of correspondence, complete with yellow, blue, and pink carbon sets, was one of them. A stack of impeccable-looking letters that would go into the boss's office, per his instructions, in the blue folder marked for your perusal, only to bounce back out after another go-round covered in coffee stains, cigarette holes, spilled scotch, red ink, and more arrows than the Indians used to fight Custer, in the green folder marked do-over. At this point, the secretary would murmur a few words about the boss's birth mother and start over again, using her innate problem-solving skills to figure out what went where and her trusty handwriting analysis decoder book to decipher the worm squiggles that passed for the boss's penmanship. This routine was interrupted about 60 times a day by a device the boss used to communicate, the signal from which, like one of Pavlov's dogs, the secretary was expected to respond with certain predictable behaviors. One buzz, pick up the phone. Two buzzes, come in for dictation. Three buzzes, refill the jawbreaker bowl on the desk. One long, continuous buzz was reserved for emergencies, like the time the boss leaned back too far in his execu-chair, fell over upside down, and needed assistance to right himself. This code could also sometimes mean he was on an overseas call and his coffee was cold. Secretaries were also required to take notes, and a popular time for this was right before noon. Sessions usually lasted 2 hours or until the secretary's fingers froze in a crab-like position, whichever came first. While they dictated at about 130 words per minute, bosses often ate lunch, So a secretary had to have a keen ear to catch what he was saying correctly, and a strong ability to concentrate should some airborne food fly out of the boss's mouth and go splat in the middle of her cenopad. In those days, there were no new hire welcome and sensitivity training podcasts. Instead, an office manager who got in a snit if anyone referred to her as anything but showed secretaries the ropes and acted as mentors. Though all of the secretary's chores were on land, these Brunhilde-like individuals always gave instructions on how to keep a tidy ship. They also gave lessons on how to cater to the boss's idiosyncrasies so as to avoid the fate of the previous 18 girls he had been forced to fire due to inefficiency or because they refused to be dinner escorts for important clients whenever said clients happened to drop into town. These indoctrination sessions taught the new girl valuable tips on things such as paperclip placement, coffee bean procurement, brewing and serving, cigar ash containment and removal, not to mention gatekeeping, restraining associates and the boss's wife from bothering him while he taped his memoirs, banking services, ensuring that $5 a month was deposited in 5 different savings and loans for each of the boss's 6 children, and crisis management, finding a London fog raincoat the boss could wrap himself up in while the office manager sewed a rip in his trousers. Okay, but that was the Neanderthal era, a time when secretaries relied on a different range of skill sets, chief among which was a heightened sense of humor. Today, thanks in large part to technology and an increased corporate awareness of inanities on the job, power containment, and the outing of sexual harassment, secretaries are doing more of the work of a collaborative assistant, thus the name change, and less the duties of an indentured servant. Now, if she can just get the boss to pick up his own shirts from the cleaners. And on to our second story. Beauty begins the moment you decide to be yourself. Coco Chanel. You've Been Doing It All Wrong by Christy Heitger Ewing. I was channel surfing the other day when I came across a Dr. Oz show that caught my attention. The segment was called Beauty Secrets Debunked. I stayed tuned because I thought I might learn a thing or two, and I did, but boy, was my education depressing. For example, did you know that plucking a gray hair from your head damages the follicles so severely that hair may not grow back there at all? And if it does, not only will the hair still grow back gray, but it will also sprout in the opposite direction as the rest of your hair, making the gray even more noticeable? I look back on all the hours I've spent cross-eyed, leaning close to the bathroom mirror, plucking away at those stray grays. And to think, I've been hastening the balding process, pluck by pluck. In addition to my eager tweezing, I've been sleeping on my side for decades now, ever since my OBGYN told me it was the best thing for pregnancy. Now Dr. Oz says that side sleeping causes delicate facial skin to wrinkle. Well, drat! The OBGYN could have at least warned me. I'll spare you the sagging breast question that Dr. Oz fielded from an audience member. Suffice it to say that the makeshift model he used to demonstrate the way in which a nursing baby and the mere passage of time impact breast tissue was nothing short of horrifying. I cringed and cupped my breasts in the same way a man reflectively grabs his privates each time he watches a video of a crotch hit. Anyone who proclaims that age is nothing more than a number has not yet begun to physically fall apart. For me, random ailments started plaguing me several years ago. Nothing that would be considered a medical disaster, but highly aggravating nonetheless. For example, I used to ride in the car for long distances without any problem. Then, one summer, I exited the passenger side of my Toyota 4Runner after a long stretch and noticed my back was insanely stiff. I shrugged it off, assuming the feeling would subside. But instead, I battled chronic back pain for several months, and this was just riding in a car. Another time, I hopped off the back of a boat's swim platform into waist-deep water. This was merely a baby hop, mind you, onto a sandy bottom lake, no less. It should have been no biggie. But when my heel hit the lake's bottom, a piercing pain shot through my right foot. Afterwards, nagging plantar fasciitis plagued me for over 6 months. I've also suffered from tennis elbow, despite the fact that I never play tennis. Doctors say this injury came about because I sleep curled on my side, as evidenced by my wrinkly face, with my right arm tucked beneath me. Bending the arm is apparently a ligament no-no. It's better to sleep with the arm outstretched, especially when a tendon is inflamed. Boy, do I miss the days when I could conk out, willy-nilly, and wake up feeling rested instead of wounded. Honestly, I think all of these irritating injuries are karma for the ribbing I gave my grandparents when I was a kid. "What do you mean you don't want to ride the roller coaster?" I'd ask Grandma and Grandpa. "It's not that bumpy," I insisted. Meanwhile, the wooden death machine whipped around the tracks so violently that my earrings would pop out. Then, too, every time my grandparents came for a visit, within an hour of arrival, they made a beeline for our sofa. "You just got here. You're seriously going to take a nap?" I'd ask with disgust. As a youngster, I could not for the life of me understand the appeal of catching Z's during daylight hours. Now, of course, I start to salivate if I know I've got a shot at 15 minutes of shut-eye, even if I've just woken up. My grandparents knew a good thing when they saw it. An empty couch, for instance. And that's not all. I remember Grandma used to go on and on about how lovely I was. In fact, she often told me, "You're so pretty, you'd look good with a burlap bag over your head." It sounded like a backhanded compliment at the time. Today, what with the wrinkles and the wily stray gray popping up here and there, the burlap bag doesn't sound like a half-bad suggestion. Still, with age comes wisdom, and now I understand the meaning of Grandma's message. I look back at my teenage pictures and realize I actually was a hottie, but I never thought so at the time. I only focused on the zit, or the freckle, or the number on the scale. I didn't appreciate what I had when I had it. Now that I'm older, my perspective has shifted. I recognize that the here and now all too quickly becomes the there and then. Grandma encouraged me to embrace my beauty, brains, health, and wellness, just as Dr. Oz has encouraged me to embrace the invention of the support bra. So these days, I let the chips fall where they may, and the gray hairs grow where they gray. And that's my beauty secret, debunked. And on to story number 3. We cannot really love anybody with whom we never laugh. Agnes Replier. Letters from My Past by Karen G. Anderson. When my 70-something parents sold their place in Massachusetts to move to a condo, they needed to dispose of my memorabilia. Over the years, it had moved from desk to file cabinet to boxes in their basement. So they gave me a choice. The boxes could go to the town dump, or they could be shipped to me in Seattle. That's why, on a damp January evening, 5 battered boxes thumped onto my bungalow porch, one of them splitting open from age and impact. I dragged the mess inside and shoved everything into a cupboard. It wasn't until the following summer, in need of closet space, that I confronted the task of sorting through the stuff. It was worse than I'd feared. I opened the first box, and a profusion of Richard Brautigan novels and psychedelic concert posters spilled out, along with a few packets of rolling papers. Toss, toss, toss. The last box I got to was stuffed with old letters. The rubber bands keeping them in bundles had disintegrated with age, and they had fallen into odd juxtapositions. High school gossip, penned in curlicue script with pink felt-tip markers on day-glow green stationery, lay beside angry poems from college friends scrawled on paper torn from notebooks and folded tightly in ways that radiated anxiety. Nearer the surface of the heap drifted letters from old boyfriends, interspersing stories about the women they'd left me to pursue, with their vague hints that our relationship still had possibilities. And there were tissue-thin pages from women who, as I recall, had always snubbed me to my face. "Dear Karen," they all had the audacity to begin. Why had I kept these letters from college and beyond? More to the point, why had I ever opened them in the first place? And now, here they were, back to remind me that I have had a lifelong inability to discard useless things, from bad boy lovers to past-its-date cottage cheese. This box of old letters was piled high with the incriminating evidence. Clearly, it had to be destroyed. Armed with a shot glass of whiskey, I brought the bottle along in case things got really bad, I sat down and started to sort through the papers. Out went the letters from my high school crush, Andy. He was a nice suburban kid, locked in eternal psychological combat with his dad, a Vietnam-era Air Force general straight out of Dr. Strangelove. In his cramped, spidery script, Andy penned self-pity and vitriol. He complained about his family and about the southwestern Mu-Yu, where an unfortunate combination of astronomical SAT scores and abysmal grades had landed him. He cursed rednecks, frat boys, and New Agers alike. Andy fled into the Arizona desert. His last letter whined that his then-girlfriend had driven off with his pickup truck, abandoning him at a roadside gas station. How picturesque, I thought, as I tossed his missives aside. And out went the letters from Sue, a quasi-famous New York designer. I'd seen her profile in an avant-garde magazine, swathed in a fashionably ghastly black outfit, her pale face frozen in an expression of terminal boredom. Sue's high school letters read more like diary entries, the kind that are intended for later autobiographical use. "Up at 4, communed with the lake, the willows," she gushed, her typing free of encumbrances like capital letters or periods. "Would visit, but I feel I must spend these last precious weeks en famille." I shook my head. This was when she was preparing to leave for college in Maryland, all of 50 miles away. The letters weren't all so ridiculous. My friend Miriam, now an anthropologist and mom in Pennsylvania, had sent postcards and letters as she hitchhiked and biked through the Rockies, Alaska, Europe, Mexico, Central America, and the Deep South. She'd chronicled the 1970s and 1980s the way I remembered them, from drug busts. "I asked myself," she wrote, "Miriam, what are you doing with these weirdos?" To Earth Day activists and bicycle freaks. "This guy in a Mercedes tried to run me off the road," the letter read, "so at the next light I snapped off his antenna." To fears of approaching yuppiehood. "I'm standing in the kitchen," she scribbled. "It's all neat and clean, and the kids are downstairs watching TV. Am I getting the housewife complex already?" God, I miss Miriam. I moved on to the letters from my 30s. These went much faster. Wedding invitations from couples long divorced, and Christmas letters from people who, after my own divorce, had sided with my ex-husband and vanished into the same deep, dark abyss I uncharitably hoped that he was in. I looked at the clock. It was getting late. In fact, it was nearly midnight when I stood up and surveyed the avalanche of dead letters at my feet. My first thought was to take them out to the recycling bin, but that seemed too kind. Perhaps it was time for the garbage? Then inspiration struck. I scooped up the papers, rushed to the fireplace, stuffed them in, and lit a few matches. I refilled my glass. Then I settled down on the couch with the marmalade cat, and we watched as my past fricasseed. In less than 10 minutes, ashes were all that remained of Nasty Andy, Pretentious Sue, and that insufferable biologist from New York. What was his name? Too late. It was gone forever. Oh, there were a few more I should have tossed. Probably the letters from Peter, a college crush who'd haunted me through graduate school. Peter wrote concerti, had a radio show, sculpted with a blowtorch, and went to medical school while touring with his rock band. I was the first woman he'd ever slept with. After we made love, he beamed with delight and announced that he was going to buy a bottle of champagne for his therapist. I'll get around to his letters next time. And our last story. I am not a glutton. I am an explorer of food. Irma Bombeck. Scaling the Weight Wall by Sharon M. Kennedy. In 1997, I was as slim and trim as any other 30-year-old divorcee in Michigan. I worked for a law firm in downtown Detroit. My respectable job required sensible suits and dresses, so I pushed my free-flowing maxi-skirts, tie-dyed T-shirts, and skin-tight size 5 Gloria Vanderbilt jeans to the back of my closet. They reappeared on the weekend, along with my cowboy boots, Outback-style Aussie hat, striped shirt, and denim vest. When I look at photographs from that time, I marvel at how thin and stylish I was. I never dreamed I'd morph into an overweight 70-year-old woman. I thought I'd always be thin. It never occurred to me something incredibly strange would happen when I turned 65. Nobody warned me I would slam into the weight wall like a hockey player hitting the boards. One day I was slim, the next day nothing fit. In my confused state, I went to the doctor, certain I had stomach tumors. When tests came back negative, I convinced myself I had celiac disease. A trip to the health food store saw me stocking up on all the gluten-free products I could find. I was sure my basket of expensive flowers, seeds, and non-GMO items would solve my phenomenal weight gain. I returned home, eager to bake a batch of sorghum cookies and a loaf of buckwheat bread. When they came out of the oven, I happily consumed them and was thoroughly disappointed. Wheat was clearly not the culprit. I could tolerate gluten as well as most people, so something else must have been responsible, for sure. Undaunted, I figured I was retaining fluids, so I made a trip to Walmart. I spent an hour reading the labels of every remedy for water retention. I purchased a variety of pills guaranteed to shed all extra liquid from my body. After a few days, I realized the pills were as useless as feathers on a dog's back. Finally, I had to admit the truth. I was fat. There was no way around it. I know the F word is politically incorrect, but when you're fat, and there's no point in trying to pretend otherwise. My metabolism had quit on me, had simply given up, while my dining habits had remained the same. An awful expression shrouded me until my brother Ed came to my rescue. He told me about the amazing Rock diet. He said it was fairly new to the market and hadn't been tested on too many rats. But he assured me it was guaranteed to work. Available research was scant, but I listened intently as Ed explained it was worth a try. After all, he said, I had nothing to lose except some extra pounds. The rock diet was simple. All I had to do was carry a rock and I would lose weight. Whenever I reached for a Snickers bar or a bag of chips, I could hold the rock in my hand, and it would prevent me from snacking. Along with a sensible diet and plenty of exercise, the rock diet was a modern miracle, my brother promised. He said most people had never heard of it because it hadn't gotten rave reviews on the Dr. Oz show. Well, I figured if one rock was good, two were better. So I went outside and found the prettiest ones I could find on the ground. I put one in my purse and one in my pocket. Then I went to town. My first stop was the Dairy Queen. As I enjoyed my hot fudge sundae, I wondered why my rocks didn't make me feel guilty. I decided ice cream must be okay. I swirled the delicious cold vanilla into a sea of thick, rich fudge sauce and heaps of salted peanuts. Oh, the delight of ice cream on a warm summer day thrilled me. Even better was the knowledge that the rock diet allowed such a pleasure. A shudder of sheer satisfaction pulsed through me. When I finished my scrumptious treat, my next stop was Arby's and some curly fries. Surely the rock diet will kick in now, I thought. But as I doused the tasty fries in a generous helping of ketchup, my rocks remained silent. I had one more stop to test the validity of the diet. I headed for Domino's and a thin crust pizza loaded with pepperoni and cheese. We all know thin crust is like eating soda crackers, and they certainly have no calories. I sat in my car and munched away while my rocks were as mute as a mime. Regardless of what I consumed, it went like that for the rest of the month. My rock diet was a total failure. So here I am, 5 years later, still overweight and still unwilling to admit defeat. I'm sure the diet just needs some little adjustment. So I'll continue carrying these rocks with me until I can squeeze into my Vanderbilts, hip huggers, and maybe even my hoard of miniskirts, the ones I found under the pile of 2X elastic-waisted baggy fleece pants. I did think about giving away the clothes and be done with it, but I'm not a quitter. Hope does indeed spring eternal in my heart. Maybe I just need to carry heavier rocks. We've run out of time for today's episode of That's a Laugh. We hope you've enjoyed it. Please be sure to listen next time. I'm Jennifer Green, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. That's a Laugh is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. Are you enjoying the show? Do you have any humorous quotes or authors you'd like to share? We'd love to hear from you. If you have any questions or comments about this or any other NCRS shows, please call us at 919-832-5138. Our number one more time is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.